Second case of the morning is National Federation of the Blind of Texas, Inc. versus Attorney General of Texas, Greg Abbott. Mr. Sullivan?
May it please the Court, James P. Sullivan for the Attorney General. Texas is here to reclaim portions of a state statute that...
Before we get started, would you please specify what is not at issue in this case? Frankly, your brief didn't do a real good job of really specifically identifying what you're not challenging from Judge Ferguson's opinion. And I think it would be helpful to have on this tape of oral argument exactly what portion of his ruling you're not challenging. For example, based on my reading of his opinion and your brief, it appears you're not challenging his holding unconstitutional having to state the amount of the fee or the amount of the percentage, but I certainly could be wrong, but I think it would help if you'd clarify that.
Yes, Judge Barksdale, and I'm sorry for that deficiency in the briefing. To state on the record the portions that we are not challenging Judge Ferguson's declaratory judgment holding unconstitutional those portions of subsections D of 922, 923, and 924 requiring disclosure of the flat fee that would be paid by the for-profit solicitor to the charitable organization. We are, however, challenging the other findings of unconstitutionality, specifically the finding concerning the sold-for-profit provisions, which are scattered throughout all of those sections of the Act in C and D, and we're challenging the finding of unconstitutionality in its entirety as to section 922, the receptacle section. And we're challenging the findings of unconstitutionality on the percentage disclosures because, as we, on our view, the case or controversy in the here does not extend.
Right. But in the alternative, assuming we said that the party did have standing on the percentage, you're not challenging his holding, just as you're not challenging having to divulge the flat fee, then you would not be challenging having to divulge the percentage.
No, that's correct, Judge Barksdale. That's exactly right. There are portions of this statute that we believe cannot be squared with the Supreme Court's opinion in Riley. But there are also portions of the statute that were declared unconstitutional that we submit were actually constitutional. And so if we could speak today about two of those pieces of the statute, both of which enable donors to make informed choices about the charitable contributions of generous Texans. The first piece will be the sold-for-profit provisions, which, as I said, are scattered throughout the statute, and the second piece will be the receptacle sections. The sold-for-profit provisions do what that name suggests. They compel professional solicitors to disclose to potential donors that donated household goods and clothing will be resold for profit. Now, Judge Ferguson correctly held that the sold-for-profit provisions survive strict scrutiny under the speech clause of the First Amendment because they are narrowly tailored to serving the compelling governmental interest in the avoidance of fraud. And this was actually a fairly simple proposition for Judge Ferguson in light of footnote 11 of the Supreme Court's Riley opinion, which was cited by Judge Ferguson. But Judge Ferguson went on, and we submit incorrectly, to hold that these sold-for-profit provisions violate the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. We submit respectfully that this was based on a simple misunderstanding about the compelling governmental interest served by the sold-for-profit provisions. The sold-for-profit provisions serve to avoid the fraud that occurs when a donation inures to private benefit without the knowledge of the donor. Now, seen in light of the substantial or the compelling governmental interest it serves, the district court's reasoning, finding that the sold-for-profit provisions were under-inclusive, does not hold up. Judge Ferguson viewed the sold-for-profit provisions, as he explained in his opinion, as under-inclusive because they didn't require charitable organizations that handle this kind of donation of household goods in-house. It didn't require those charities to disclose that goods would be resold. But forcing a disclosure that goods would be resold would not avoid the fraud that the sold-for-profit provisions were intended to combat in the state of Texas.
What about, and I've wondered about this, and I'm not sure it's in this case, we all know that not-for-profit entities have expenses related to the resale of these items. And so they're not donating dollar for dollar these items to needy persons. They're taking their expenses off the top as well. So is that part of this case, the fact that a not-for-profit also has fees or expenses that it's not divulging to the public, and that's why it's under-inclusive?
It's not part of the case, Judge Barksdale, and it's not part of the case because the intuition that you have and that you've just expressed about the fees that any charitable organization will have is exactly correct, and indeed it's confirmed by the Supreme Court's opinion in Riley. As both Justice Scalia concurring in the judgment in that case and Justice Brennan's majority opinion made clear, it is assumed by everybody that there's going to be some portion of overhead. If I'm knocking on your door and asking you to donate your couch to save the whales, I presumably drove to your house, and presumably I'm going to drive away with the couch if I do a good enough pitch, and there's going to be some sort of overhead cost. But that isn't the fraud that we're trying to prevent here. The evidence that was before the Texas legislature and the problem that they were trying to solve was the problem that occurs when a for-profit entity has inserted itself without the public's knowledge into the transaction between the charitable organization and the donor. That's the thing of which generous Texans are unaware, and it's that kind of benevolent ignorance that people have that was the target of the Supreme Court's footnote 11 in Riley. While it was assumed that everybody knows that there are going to be some sort of expenses in the charitable solicitation process, it's not commonly known that for-profit entities have found a way to take a cut right off the top and to find a way to make some of the donor's charitable donation inure to private benefit. So this is not a case, at least with regard to the sold-for-profit provisions, about the fact that not 100% of every donation goes directly toward the charitable end on whose behalf the solicitation is made.
Now, in this case, the parties were paying a flat fee.
That's correct.
Right? And there was no party or there was no discussion that there would be a percentage paid.
Yes, Judge Prado.
And I believe your position is then that the judge did not have the standing, or they did not have standing to challenge the percentage portion of the ruling?
That is our argument. That's correct. The percentage disclosure portions, there's nothing in the record, and my friend in opposition has pointed to nothing in the briefs, and I submit that you won't find it, suggesting that the Federation, the two charities that I'm referring to collectively as the Federation, either use any sort of a percentage disclosure mechanism in their charitable relationship or in their relationships with for-profit solicitors, nor have they disclosed any concrete and immediate intent to do so in the future. And so subsections C, which are the percentage disclosure sections of 922, 923, and 924, they do not affect the behavior of the Federation. Therefore, there's no injury in fact. And we submit that the case or controversy in the Article III sense does not extend to those portions of the statute.
What about the effect that if they can't use use the fee provision, they have to turn to the percentage provision? In other words, if I'm a charitable organization and you've told me that I have to that I have to divulge the fee, then I'm going to have to say, well, but then I'm going to have to go to a percentage because I don't want to divulge the fee. I mean, isn't there some overlap there that even under the very narrow standards we judge standing on this sort of context, it just seems that the two overlap sufficiently, perhaps?
Judge Barksdale, we would concede that there is some overlap between the provisions, and this seemed to serve as the basis of Judge Ferguson's finding that the Article III case or controversy here did extend to the percentage disclosure sections. But we would respectfully submit that the overlap is not so great as to expand federal jurisdiction to cover sections of the statute that are not implicated on the facts of this case and on this record. And this is actually similar to the Davis case, which is cited in our brief, which involved two different subsections of the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act. They were actually two subsections, numbered A and B, of the same section of the statute. One of them dealt with disclosure requirements for people who were self-financing campaigns, and the other subsection dealt with asymmetrical campaign contribution limits. So there was definitely some overlap, and they were targeted toward the same end. But when the Supreme Court did its Article III standing analysis, it didn't assume that just because it had found some jurisdictional hook within the statute, that it then threw open the entire Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, or even the entire section with two numbered subsections, to judicial review. Instead, the court individually said, does subsection A apply in this case? And it found that it did. Does subsection B apply in this case? And found that it did. And then it adjudicated the constitutionality of both pieces, even though there was some overlap. And in this case, we submit that Judge Ferguson's finding of standing to challenge the percentage disclosure sections here had to do with some sort of severability analysis. And I must concede that I'm a little bit confused about what the relationship is between severability and standing here, and why severability would expand federal jurisdiction to cover a portion of the statute that's not an issue in this case.
Why would you have standing over something that is severable as opposed to not? I mean, I think his rationale was somewhat backwards with respect to holding that he had jurisdiction to determine constitutionality.
I would agree with that analysis, and I may have failed to understand it quite as well as you did. I think that it was based on severability, but I don't think that the severability analysis got the district court where it was hoping to go in an Article III sense, in part because I don't believe that the severability analysis was correct. Of course, as this court has recognized, severability is a question of state law. Under the Texas Code Construction Act, found at 311.032C of the Texas Government Code, a statute should be found severable if the portions, if you remove the portion adjudicated unconstitutional, if the remainder can operate and have some full effect as a law, then it's severable. And so in this case, we would submit that the percentage disclosure sections are severable. Now, to return to Judge Barksdale's question, there is some amount of overlap. And you may find that, for instance, in this case, if the Federation is able to show that the flat fee provisions that do affect it were unconstitutional, then there may be some dynamic effect on the charitable market in Texas where charities would say, oh, okay, we're going to shift then from percentage disclosure arrangements to flat fee arrangements, because if we do the flat fees, then we don't have to disclose anything. But we submit that the percentage disclosure section can stand independently as a law, even if there is some overlap between the provisions. And because it can stand as a law, it is severable as a matter of state law. And therefore, even if severability analysis informed the Article III standing analysis, that argument would fail on its own terms. So we would submit that the judgment should be vacated insofar as percentage disclosure provisions of the statute were held unconstitutional, and the cause remanded there for a dismissal for want of subject matter jurisdiction.
As I understand it, the district court held that the plaintiffs did not have standing to challenge the disclosure required if none of the money is going for charitable purposes. I can't understand how a charity could say, give us money, but we're not giving it to anybody. But in any event, based on the fact that there was no standing, therefore no one was before the court urging that position, how is it the district court then held constitutional the provision that the not giving any for charitable purposes was constitutional just by default?
I think that there, Judge Ferguson had a proper understanding of the limited federal judicial role where Article III limits subject matter jurisdiction, and I think he appropriately declined to pass judgment on those portions of the statute. Of course, the dynamic effect that I've just described between percentage and flat fee arrangements might also be found in the separate section of subsection B, because you could say, well, if we don't want to disclose anything, we'll give one penny to charity, and then we will not have given 0% value.
But that wasn't what was happening.
But that was
that,
just a
potential. It's not before the court yet.
That's correct, Judge Clement.
Before your time lapses, I could not find in the record excerpts or in the briefs any description of what is on these receptacles. I didn't see it in the stipulations. What is on a typical receptacle?
Well, Judge Barksdale, I submit that your thorough review of the record, and if you look at the whole thing, you will be similarly confounded in your search to find what is on these records, because my friend in opposition has not put anything in the record about the speech that they wish to convey and that is regulated by these sections of the statute. My friend points to affidavits that were attached to the complaint beginning at page 29 of the record, but I submit that these don't say very much about what is on these receptacles. Probably the most descriptive thing you'll find are the photographs that were attached to an amicus brief by the Texas Association of Goodwills beginning at 185 of the record. They attached some photographs of donation receptacles. It's unclear, though, whether those are even receptacles in Texas, and I would also add Goodwill was supporting us and supporting our law. And so, and I'll have to use some of my rebuttal time, and I apologize in advance, to talk about the receptacle sections. So until then, I'll yield.
May it please the court. My name is Earl Koppelwitz. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiffs in this case, the National Federation of the Blind and the Institute for Disability Access, also known as ADAPT. The plaintiffs are small organizations lacking name recognition, but have dedication equal to their cause of any of the charities serving the residents of Texas. Because they lack name recognition and visibility, they depend upon alternative and creative ways to draw support. Direct mail and telemarketing require a great deal of resources, which neither of these organizations possess. Likewise, they lack the manpower and the physical ability to conduct volunteer activities to create these sources of income. The opportunity to be supported by the public, which is simply being asked to donate unwanted clothing and household discards, is particularly attractive. These programs serve the public in two ways. First, they're a source of much-needed funding for the organizations like the plaintiffs, and secondly, they provide an outlet for goods other than overwhelming our landfills and littering our streets. It also gives the opportunity to people who might not otherwise be able to participate in a philanthropic movement by making cash donations to participate by donating their used clothing and other items. This source of income is vital to these organizations, and we believe the decision of Judge Ferguson was correct and should be sustained. I would also like to point out to the stipulation of facts in this case. Number one says the plaintiffs are Texas nonprofit corporations which have engaged in and intend to engage in activities regulated by the Act. The Attorney General agreed to that stipulation, and that is the law of the case. And I think that solves a lot of the issues involving standing in the application and the severability provisions that were here. Government cannot favor one speaker over another, passing laws to support one speaker and shutting out others' fully protected speech. Appellants can't deny the improper purpose of the law found in the legislative history was to favor Goodwill's big business over others by burdening the speech of the plaintiffs and others similarly situated. Strict scrutiny, as the lower court ruled, properly applies to the Act because it's content-based restriction of speech that is fully protected by the First and 14th Amendments.
About turning to the receptacles, why, again, advise us what is in the record about the record evidence about, I'm not sure an amicus brief can provide evidence, but what is the record evidence about what is on the receptacles? And then, after you've done that, why that is not commercial speech?
Well, the affidavit of the Institute for Disability Access at item 4 says they put service messages on their bins. Section 5 of the affidavit of the National Federation of Texas says that fundraising attracts new members and people who need help. I was asked the question in the oral argument in Riley by Justice Brennan, who wrote the majority opinion, whether simply asking to give money is a form of fully protected speech. And if so, why? And I responded then, and I believe it is reflected through the course of the decision in Riley, that in order to say simply give money in the name of an organization carries with it a persuasion, an information, a need, and a cause. If it doesn't, then it won't be successful. But surely names like the Red Cross, the Salvation Army, the American Cancer Society, if I say support the American Cancer Society, it carries a protected message, and the court determined that while some aspects of fundraising may have a commercial aspect to them, once they get involved with the appeal for a cause, then it becomes intertwined and we give the entire speech the full protection of the First Amendment.
Yes, sir, but what is on the receptacle that is record evidence that is along that line?
The stipulation, the affidavit says there are service messages. The names of the organizations are on here. Support the National Federation of the Blind. Give us your used discards and used clothing. Connotes a message of an advocacy to support the National Federation of the Blind. The appeal by the National Federation of the Blind in any form is a form of fully protected speech. And I believe that the Riley case stands for that in a number of ways. And I can certainly quote you.
That may well be. I'm just trying to find out what is on these receptacles.
Well, you would have to have something on the receptacles to encourage people to support your organization.
Yes, sir. And my question is, what does the affidavit explicitly say is on the message, on the receptacle, other than a service message?
It says a service message is on the bins, and the Federation of Blind says having the bins attracts new members. It's a form of fundraising. And we have represented the National Federation.
Language is on the receptacle? What exact language? I know it's the message.
I can't quote you the words of what's on the ADAPT bin. The affidavit is there is a service message talking about the organization.
You've said that probably four times.
Yes.
You don't know what.
I can't.
Does
Barksdale
and I are asking you what are the words on the receptacles on the bins? If you don't know, just say you don't know.
I don't know.
That's pretty bad that you don't know.
Well, it's a message of asking for support for their program.
Yeah, now you've said it six times. Okay.
The issue of standing and severability, the court found standing.
What was the basis for that standing by the district court?
Partially is the Texas stipulation that the parties are engaged, and I would suggest to you that the stipulation also goes to the language on the receptacles because there's stipulation it does apply. Article 3 standing was granted on the issue. What the Attorney General tends to argue in its brief is a view of standing from its inception rather than from the position that standing is already there on the flat fee arrangement. If you look at the Fifth Circuit cases, and particularly RTM Media and Fairchild, they recognized relaxed prudential rationale for third-party standing to prevent the chilling effect. Clearly, there's a chilling effect on the percentages. The disclosure of percentages on what is being given to the charitable organization is exactly the same as what was at issue in Schomburg, Munson, and Riley, where the disclosures of percentages.
But isn't this percentage a potential percentage? Your client's not saying that they're actually charging a percentage.
No, our clients currently have contracts on a flat fee.
Right. So why do you have standing to challenge the percentage component today?
Because to take it out would be a gaping hole, that it's clearly unconstitutional. It clearly is overbroad. It clearly has a chilling effect. It comes within the overbreath doctrine. It's not narrowly tailored. It requires strict scrutiny. These are all forms of speech.
If there's a proper plaintiff before the court that establishes a case or controversy, yes. But if that plaintiff doesn't engage in this particular activity,
the stipulation by the Attorney General is that the Act covers these parties and they cannot disengage from what they've already conceded. If they would have not entered into that stipulation of fact, we may have brought another plaintiff that has a percentage into this, but given their stipulations, it wasn't necessary.
Well, I don't believe parties can confer or decide standing. That's for the court.
I understand, but the standing is conceded and the unconstitutionality on the flat fee is there. Now, the question is whether we're proper parties under jus terci standing and under Munson to bring the claim to adjudicate the unconstitutionality. Here, the Attorney General seems to be conceding that if there was standing, it's unconstitutional. On the percentages, clearly under Riley, it would be unconstitutional. Clearly, under the standards, whether we're a proper party under Munson, to advocate for third parties not before the court, we fill that bill. We are doing business with resellers of unwanted discards. We have the right, the causal connection. It's form over substance. The court properly ruled under Sorrell that there's a gaping hole if you sever that provision. What benefit is it to the state of Texas or its citizens to have a law that
the Attorney General concedes that if there were a if it was severed and there was a second lawsuit, they would lose that one as well. Judicial economy, common sense, and overbreath and the chilling effect compels affirmance of what the court held in that regard. Why would the state of Texas, whose duty is to protect its citizens, want to defer the constitutional ruling when they recognize it's content-based and is a form of prior restraint?
Would you agree that the state of Texas in this case has a compelling interest in this case?
Their compelling interest is to prevent fraud. Fraud is not the fact that there are expenses. In the Riley case, there was a disclosure of a percentage. What the court held in footnote 13 was that an unambiguous statement of fact that a professional fundraiser was being employed was sufficient knowledge. In fact, Justice Scalia wrote a concurring opinion dissenting on that part, in part, saying that that shouldn't even be necessary because if somebody, if you think somebody's a volunteer, you would think they would want to disclose that. It should be the presumption that everybody's getting paid to do work. But what the court held in Riley is this disclosure of professional status gives enough notice. That's narrowly tailored. The state of Texas wants to go further and deal with the economic relationship and disclose that between the charity and the professional. That same expense may be had by Goodwill or other major charities that conduct the very same activity in-house using their own employees, and they can avoid it. And that's where the court ruled on the under-inclusive nature and the equal protection argument in this case. And that's exactly what the Supreme Court held in Riley.
So are you disagreeing with counsel for the state that the question I asked him about is one of the sub-issues included in this appeal on the equal protection under-inclusive, the fact that some for-profit charities, I'm sorry, some not-for-profits use in-house and therefore they don't have to use a third party, but they still, as you've just said, and as we all know, have expenses, et cetera. It's not dollar-for-dollar charity. Is that part of the under-inclusiveness, or is it simply, as the state argues, oh, no, it's limited to the fact that not-for-profits that do it in-house don't have a third-party intermediary?
Well, the fact that they don't have a third-party mediary relieves them of the obligation of disclosure of the professional status of the professional. But it does not and should not, and as the court ruled, could not allow them to avoid the other disclosures that would be put on the smaller charities like our clients that use the outside professionals. The fact that it's resold may be resold by Goodwill. I suspect they get many items they can't use and they get rid of in a different market. The fact that they have expenses is the same as our clients. At the end of the day, the bottom line and the net profit to the charitable organization may be exactly the same, but one is being placed under a disability because it's too small to hire a huge workforce. And Goodwill wrote this legislation. That's clear in the legislative history, and it was done for a competitive purpose so that they would not have to make disclosures that are required by the other organizations that are not large enough to have in-house facilities.
Well, but isn't the distinction really that some charities are employing these for-profit solicitors? How could they be in the same, similarly situated with charities who do not, who use volunteer work or who have expenses? I think the public needs to know there's a for-profit third party.
And we don't object to that. And that's footnote 13 in the Riley case. And that's what Judge Ferguson said. He severed a portion of the disclosures in saying you can require professional status and put people on notice. If you're worried about fraud, the fact that people have costs in and of itself is not a form of fraud. We know that from all of these cases. What the state can do if they want to educate people, they can require filings, registrations, and do public education and provide information to citizens across the board. That's what the states were instructed to do in Schomburg. Again, they were instructed in Munson, and again, they were instructed in Riley, and again, they were instructed in Madigan. What they can't do is create these broad prophylactic rules that create some kind of economic barrier to speech. My clients have the same right to seek support as Goodwill Industry does. My clients don't have the physical ability to conduct the same kinds of activity.
I'm sure you didn't make a concession, but I want to just make sure I understand what you're saying. The state of Texas, as we've had confirmed at the start of argument, is not claiming that the provisions in this statute, they're not challenging the provisions about having to state the amount of the flat fee or the percentage. They are challenging the holding that having to disclose for profit is unconstitutional. Now, you're not agreeing that you're not agreeing with the state on that, are you? You're not saying, yeah, it's okay to have to put for profit.
No. What I'm saying is the provision of having to advise on these bids or in solicitations that the person who's making the solicitation is a professional. What the state is saying that it's sold for profit.
Right. You don't agree with the state on that.
Oh, absolutely not, because it's under-inclusive, because it's not being compelled by the in-house operations, much the same way in Riley. The court talked about there. It has to apply across the board. And Judge,
is there any evidence in the record that Goodwill sells or any other in-house not-for-profit sells for profit?
This was submitted not on facts. I mean, this is a case on summary judgment. There was no factual record other than the stipulation of facts that were involved in this case. There was no other record. What Judge Ferguson ruled was that this was an unconstitutional content-based restriction on free speech, and certainly Playboy Enterprises and the Riley case support that. And I also want to go to the FEC versus Davis case that the state seems to rely upon. The distinction in the FEC versus Davis case was that that was not a First Amendment or a prior restraint or chilling effect type of statute. It wasn't a decision based on just tertiary standing and overbreath under the First Amendment. Judge Ferguson ruled that the statute at bar was unconstitutionally under-inclusive and violated the Equal Protection Clause because it only applied to those who worked with outside agents, again violating the standards in Riley, that it was overbroad because it reaches otherwise fully protected speech and creates a chilling effect, and it creates a prior restraint by compelling speech that the fundraisers or the agencies would not otherwise utter. We ask on behalf of our clients that Judge Ferguson's ruling be affirmed, and we thank you for your time.
All right, Mr. Sullivan, you have some rebuttal time.
Thank you. I'd like to begin very quickly on the standing issue. The state of Texas would be derelict in its duty if it invited any federal court to exceed the constitutional limits on federal judicial power as set forth in Article 3. And the relaxations of prudential standing, such as the jus tertii or the overbreadth doctrines, have nothing to do with the Article 3 question. And we've spelled that out in our brief. As to the point about under-inclusiveness and the equal protection challenge to the sold-for-profit provisions, I think Judge Clement's question put it just right, which is that the charitable organizations that use for-profit solicitors are not similarly situated with charitable organizations that do their solicitation in-house. And Judge Barksdale's question furthered that, where he asked, was there any record evidence that charitable organizations like Goodwill are selling donated goods for profit? There is no such evidence, and indeed that would be a separate type of fraud, and we can cross that bridge when we come to it. Because they're not similarly situated, there is no equal protection violation in requiring that a charitable organization and its professional solicitor disclose that there's been a for-profit intermediary introduced into the process. Finally, if we could speak for a moment about the receptacle sections, some of the questions of my friend in opposition have pointed out the dearth of record evidence in this case about what is on these receptacles. And I'd like to point out what the legal impact of that lack of record evidence does in this case. What it does is that it cuts the legs out from under Judge Ferguson's finding of facial unconstitutionality under the First Amendment overbreadth doctrine. As the New York Clubs case, which is cited in our brief, points out, there has to be some record evidence to show that there is a substantially overbroad statute that sweeps in a number of unconstitutional applications enough to counterbalance the plainly legitimate sweep of the statute. Now, in our case, we submit that the receptacle sections do have a plainly legitimate sweep, because as to those applications for which a receptacle only conveys commercial speech, for those applications of the statute, strict scrutiny would not apply because it's purely commercial speech. And if strict scrutiny doesn't apply, and I think my friend has not argued this, argued to the contrary in the briefs, if it's only intermediate scrutiny under the commercial speech doctrine, then under a case like Zouderer, this is a very easy case. The point is to prevent deceptive commercial speech. So then there's going to be a range of applications for which the receptacle section is constitutional, and the hypothesized existence, but nothing in the record to show, a range of applications that might be unconstitutional because of some sort of inextricable intertwining of fully protected with commercial speech. But because there has been no such record made in this case, the finding of facial unconstitutionality as to the receptacle sections should be reversed. And finally, I'd like to, if I could just read a portion of the stipulations of fact to return briefly to the standing issue here. I believe my friend is referring to paragraph 1 of the stipulations of fact, which you'll find at page 102 of the record. And what that provides is, plaintiffs are Texas nonprofit corporations which have engaged in and intend to engage in activities regulated by the Act, and then cites the Act. It doesn't say that they intend to engage in activities that are regulated by every section of the Act. So I don't think that the stipulation does quite as much work as it's being relied on to do here. So if I could briefly sum up then and hopefully make up for the deficiency in the briefs to say exactly what we're asking for here. Our conclusion section is much longer than the usual. The judgment should be reversed or the judgment should be affirmed. What we're asking for is for the court to vacate the portion of the declaratory judgment insofar as it held unconstitutional the percentage sections of the Act, because there was no Article III case or controversy as to those. Should vacate and remand with instructions to dismiss for want of jurisdiction. Secondly, we would ask that the court reverse the judgment insofar as the sold-for-profit provisions scattered throughout the Act were held unconstitutional under the Equal Protection Clause, because as we've tried to point out today, those sections are not under-inclusive because charities that use for-profits and charities that don't are not similarly situated. And finally, we would ask that the court reverse the declaratory judgment insofar as the receptacle section, Section 922 of our statute, was held unconstitutional. If there are no further questions, I'll yield my remaining 28 seconds.
All right. Thank you.